Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Everybody, welcome to this special edition of A Good Football Show, where we are beginning a weekly division preview series. I am Patrick Daugherty, joined today by Mr. Patrick Crane. We begin in the mean streets of the AFC South with a pair of special guests and Titans beat writer Buck Rising and Jaguars beat writer John Shipley. We also check in on the Colts and the Texans' infinite sadness. First, we would like to welcome in A to Z Sports and 104.5 The Zone's Buck Rising. Buck, how are we doing today?
We're doing great. I appreciate you boys having me on. Mean streets of the AFC South. It's probably the worst division in football, boys. I don't know how mean it gets out there, but it's a pretty good time, and they're always interesting, all four of them.
Well, they also got rid of, like, the one guy in the division who would have been, like, really likely to let it fight dirty, you know, an Urban Meyer. And so the streets are probably considerably less mean this year.
Oh, but I miss him. I miss the holy hell out of him, especially with 3 hours of sports talk radio.
There's always something. We miss him just for podcast content. For sure. Yeah. Which, you know, is like 1 or 2 hours a week where you've got, what, 15 hours a week? And, like, yeah. Urban Meyer probably filled, what, 13 to 14 of that last year?
Well, yeah, he made a streaming show on top of the radio show every once in a while. Like, he's the content that keeps on giving. And, you know, I appreciate that even NFL teams like the Chargers in their schedule release video are going to commemorate Uncle Urban's memory the way that they did. I thought that was pretty nice.
Yeah, I think we'll be commemorating the Urban Meyer year. I was about to say years. Oh, yeah. We'll be commemorating the Urban Meyer year for many years to come because to so many precious memories. And by the way, I say the mean streets. I've brought this up on the podcast before. I was in an elevator. This is a true story with Mike Vrabel at the Super Bowl. It was just me and Mike Vrabel, and I didn't bother him. He didn't seem like he wanted. It just seemed like he could have killed me, like, right there on the spot. And it seemed like maybe he wanted to. I didn't even say it. I didn't want to bother him. But I was like, yep, he would definitely just instantly kill me if he wanted to.
So, yeah, a press conference with Mike on any given day is a bit of a roller coaster because he wants to fight every time he's up there. And, like, he's not – you know, I don't know if you guys have seen some of the clips that come out of our press conferences, our media availabilities, but yeah, Mike likes to play with his food a little bit at the podium, so it can get pretty nasty out there. And also, his hands are the size of my head, so if he really wanted to crush me like a grape, he could do it.
That was the thing, maybe not to get too graphic, where he could have done like the mountain thing to me from Game of Thrones if he really wanted to.
I think my friend Diana Russini asked him before a Ravens game if he had to fight John Harbaugh, who would win. And I think he pretty he played it off pretty nicely, but I think we all know that Mike would win.
Yeah, he would. He went viral, a few times for his press interactions. I forget about the one where he got real upset and he walked out. But
name a day. It could be Zach Cunningham, and he doesn't want to talk about the fact that Zach Cunningham may or may not be active. It could be that somebody asked him what it was like to play for Bill Belichick, and Mike doesn't like to talk about what it was like to play for Bill Belichick, so he'll go at you any number of ways. He's got a highlight reel. I put one together one time. It's pretty good.
That's a weird Mike Vrabel loophole, by the way, where I feel like I kind of consider him a Bill Belichick disciple, like, because, you know, he's so associated with Bill Belichick, but like you said, he never actually coached for Bill Belichick.
Yeah, but he's got the Belichick thing to him. Like, he's definitely got the New England, like, find the loopholes. He's on the competition committee. He understands the rule book. better than the officials. Hell, they beat Tom Brady in his last game as a Patriot with that weird punt, kneel down, kill the clock type thing that Belichick had come up with, I think, against the Jets. They used that in a playoff game, and I think there's still a meme of Bill going around just losing his damn mind about, you know, getting out Belichick.
Yeah, I kind of doubt they've spoken since then.
I think they're pretty good. Every time we have joint training camp practices with somebody, it's either Brady and the Buccaneers or Brady, whichever team he plays for, and the Patriots. So they keep in touch.
Yeah, Brady's now part owner of the Miami Dolphins, I believe. I stopped following NFL news about February 27th this offseason. So I'm assuming nothing has happened since then.
Just a ridiculous, like, people don't want to believe the conspiracy theories that are actually happening in the NFL. And you're like, look at this one that almost happened in front of everybody's faces, if not for an unprecedented lawsuit. Like, the fact that more people didn't talk about that still blows my mind.
Yeah, I know. I would say all NFL conspiracy theories, none of them are true except for everyone involving the Dolphins. All of those ones, like, are true.
Perpetual.
They're very prone to the Crane. I swear you'll get to talk at some point, by the way. just sitting there like a polite young Irish man.
I'll get in there at some point.
We're here to talk about the Tennessee Titans. And Buck, really the only thing we've been talking about with the Titans so far this offseason is Treylon Burks' breathing. And by the way, I'm asthmatic, by the way, so I'll cast some asthma stones, maybe.
Excellent.
Mine's actually very well controlled, by the way. Thank you to Symbacort, the wonderful makers of Symbacort. But you are obviously much more inside the team than we are. But from an outside perspective, you know, we were just talking about Mike Vrabel. It seems like he is quick to sour on people. And just like, how much do you think this is already a concern for Treylon Burks? Going into the summer, like, is he already like out of favor with the coaching staff? Not that they're going to like immediately turn on like their first round pick. How much of this is that it's May and June and we're bored and a guy couldn't finish a practice? Or is there like any actual there with the Treylon Burks conditioning issues?
Sure. I think that once it became a recurring situation, yeah, it's fair to be concerned. And listen, the air quality down here in Nashville, especially when it's been triple digits for the past basically 10 days here, if you're somebody who deals with asthma, we're one of the worst places in the country as far as summer air quality is concerned. Now, the guy played at Arkansas. It's not like the conditions in Nashville, Tennessee are drastically different. So it's fair to wonder, okay, is it a conditioning situation? I've asked Mike about this before, if there's kind of a little bit of an expectation for them to come in. You know, they got to work themselves into shape. And he's always talked about, well, everybody's got their own guy, right? And so you can try as many different ways to simulate what it is that we do here with your own people, especially if you're not somebody who's gone through an NFL offseason before, and it just not be the same. Now, as far as Mike's concerned, he's always had, you know, he's always had a certain way of dealing with people, and he's not going to protect them overtly when it comes to production. Now, in places like injury, Mike might as well be giving out an NHL injury report with upper and lower.
I know. Body. I was going to say, I feel like we have to do the injury updates. You know, that's one of our website's main thing. Yeah,
we don't do them.
Yeah, I feel like he should maybe get fined more often because it's very vague. And not.
Again, if you want to look at Belichickian resemblances, injuries and the rule book, that's kind of where it starts.
Being vague, I mean, he described in minicamp Burks as unavailable. Was that related to asthma? Was that related to conditioning? Is it possible he was nursing some kind of actual injury? Like, do you have any sense of what unavailable meant?
Yeah, it's a conditioning situation alongside with the asthma. There hasn't been anything, any indications, no reporting or nobody locally outside of what we've been able to discern that's had some kind of injury situation. He's not out there on the practice field that often. So for us to peel through the amount of practice footage that we have to try and find the spot where he may have done something hasn't been fruitful thus far. So Mike will always defer to, you know, we come up with individual plans for all the guys. They're on individual plans. And, you know, he said the same thing. If you want to keep it to conspiracy theory type stuff. He said the same thing of Jeffrey Simmons, who was physically here for mandatory minicamp, but is having a bit of a contract hold in, if not full on hold out, just simply unavailable. And that's about all the detail that we typically get on the front end without having to do our own homework.
Yeah, the hold end is becoming a new phenomenon, by the way. I think several Seahawks players did that last year. And like, I was like, man, I guess the holdouts are over. Now they get fined like $1.5 million a day.
Now you just bring them in, put them on a bike and let them watch practice. That's basically been the experience here.
And they get to test the new exercise equipment. What do you, Buck? So, I mean, what are the odds Treylon Burks passes the training camp conditioning tests? Like, how do the Titans handle that kind of thing? Like, will they like try to teach Burks a lesson now? Or if he shows up and is ready to go, they'll clear him immediately. The spring, all will be forgotten, and then they jump into Treylon Burks' NFL.
Yeah, it depends on what he looks like when he reports, right? I mean, we're a month away to a day, as a matter of fact, from the first Titans training camp practice. So, you know, provided that he does the things necessary over the course of a month, it's not a long amount of time. I mean, it feels like we just broke from mandatory minicamp and we're already almost halfway through this portion of the NFL summer vacation. They'll make him available as soon as he's, you know, as soon as he reports. They'll find out through the conditioning situation whether he's ready to go. And if he's not ready to go, then they'll put him out there. Like, their expectation is, okay, if you're not going to come in prepared, you're going to go out there unprepared, and then you're going to have to deal with the consequences of that kind of stuff. That's typically been the approach. Now, again, you know, there's how much of that goes into the meetings, how much of that is their actual plan. We don't know these things because we're not in the pre-Monday or pre-media availability meeting that he has with all of them, where he goes over the headlines that they are and are not going to answer questions about.
I know it's a murky situation, so this is basically asking you to make a guess here, but sure. Who do you think is ultimately the most targeted Titans wideout this year, Treylon Burks or Robert Woods?
You know, I would venture a guess and say Robert Woods. I mean,
not what we want to hear.
His availability has been surprising. I mean, yeah, from a fantasy standpoint, no, that's definitely. No,
I mean, well, this is a fantasy show. I mean, we only care about the shiny new thing.
No, I hear you. Listen, Burks, so. I mean, he tore his ACL the week after the Titans kicked the Rams' ass on Sunday Night Football in L.A.
on NBC.
In practice on NBC. That's correct.
Sorry, they do not make us do that.
No, but you should. You know why? And that's how you're gonna. That's how you're gonna keep doing that. Keep that up. No, I. So to see him out there, like the first day of the voluntary stuff. He was out there. He looked pretty fluid. He's got the knee brace on, sure. But, you know, I wouldn't discount the Kyle Phillips situation in this offense. It's the first time since one good season of Adam Humphries that they've had a true slot option. And I think it's going to go back to tight end heavy sets. I mean, they got away from who they were last year. A lot of three wide receivers on the field. They had 91 different players put on that uniform. They had to do it based on the sheer amount of attrition. But in Austin Hooper, who's a bit of a reclamation project, in Chigakonkwo, I would expect a lot of 12, a lot of 21 to get those tight ends involved creatively, kind of the way that you saw Arthur Smith do it.
That's weird. You kind of brought up an interesting point that I mean, a very obvious point that I hadn't even thought about. Like, maybe not the greatest sign for Treylon Burks' like rookie like fantasy workload when the guy coming off a torn ACL is already practicing more than like the young college guy.
Yeah,
just had a first round pick. That's a pretty interesting way to frame it.
The whole thing has been super perplexing. Honestly, this has been one of the more dramatic off seasons that we've had with nonsense like this, because Tannehill doesn't want to mentor Malik Willis and AJ Brown is forcing a trade. And all of a sudden the first round pick that they traded up for has got an asthma problem when the last two, Caleb Farley, still hasn't played snaps of consequence. And Isaiah Wilson, I think, is, you know, still coming up on police reports as far as his off the field indiscretion, shall we call them. So, yeah, it's been pretty spicy here, but it does not. If you are looking at Burks as a fantasy play, there has been zero evidence so far through the offseason that he is going to pay off in any way of consequence.
You mentioned Kyle Phillips. Do you view him as sort of ahead of Nick Westbrook-Ikhine in the sense that, assuming Burks gets together, it would presumably be Woods and Burks on the outside and a three wide receiver set with Phillips in the slot?
Yeah, I wouldn't presume that it would be Burks. Nick Westbrook-Ikhine is somebody who is an undrafted guy, has I mean, it was a bit of a joking point. His first training camp, the fact that he would physically fight the football as opposed to catching it, and you know, out of sheer need, he's figured out a way to play all three positions in their offense that they asked the wide receivers to. So I would imagine that it would be Woods and Nick Westbrook-Ikhina out of the gate if you're looking at X and Z receivers, with Phillips in the slot and probably Austin Hooper is the starting tight end. Chig will get playing time too.
So yeah, Hooper is the starting tight end. But like last year, we kept like expecting like a Titans tight end, like start getting like enough targets you could like stream in fantasy. And that just never happened. Like, you think Hooper, I don't even know how familiar you are with fantasy. I mean, how do you think Hooper will see enough targets to be a guy who will at least like maybe catch three or four passes a week?
Yes, without question. I think the amount of malfunctions that they had last year, you know, Derrick Henry notwithstanding, just across the board as far as availability was concerned. And the tight end group was the most disappointing group on the roster, bar none. I don't think that they regret not paying Jonnu Smith, what was it, $50
million? $52 million, I believe.
To go underperform in New England, but what they had on that COVID cap at the tight end position was not nearly sufficient enough. They look great so far, Tannehill and Austin Hooper. It's something that he seems to really thrive on, the connection there with that position, especially as Todd Downing gets into an offensive system that's a little more comfortable for everybody. I would expect Hooper to see, I would take the over on 3 to 4 catches a game.
That's pretty interesting intel, because he's really jumbled in like the fantasy rankings, like between like 10 to 20 amongst the tight ends. So like a guy
he's
with
the
track
most
record
promising
too.
Thing that we've seen on the offensive side of the football is the two of them, Tannehill and Hooper. That's the thing that's really caught everybody's attention. Cause you know, I mean, they're dealing with five new starters. They're basically going to run the ball and play defense for the first month until they figure out who the hell they can trust on the outside.
So speaking of running the ball, you know, after years of like unmatched durability, Derrick Henry is returning from injury. I would say finally returning from injury. It's not like it's just like you kept waiting for a guy who handles those kind of workloads to get hurt, and he just never did. He's been hurt now. He's 28. You know, some of the modern era's biggest workloads ever behind him. Do you envision any change in his usage, or is that just a silly thought? Derrick Henry is going to be Derrick Henry until the wheels fall off.
Basically. They're going to run him into the ground. They're going to get the full bulk cap hit out of that contract. He's pretty cost effective. And I think there's like $3 million guaranteed left on his deal over the course of the next two seasons. It's not something that for Derrick's, you know, physical well-being.
Yeah. So Derrick, best of luck.
Yeah. He's going to do it. Like he is the unstoppable force, even when the efficiency went way down. I know people who study the advanced metrics, probably on a much more granular level, can speak to specific numbers. But obviously, he got contacted a lot more behind the line of scrimmage and at the line of scrimmage than we were used to seeing. But they didn't have anything else. They just kept running Derrick Henry, whereas he's in every other season, he's always been a bit of a slow starter. And then as, you know, attrition wears down the other teams, it's still a 250-pound, 6'4" running back, you know, running through your face mask and stiff-arming you to the center of the earth. So his whole thing is it's going to be pretty interesting, but I would not envision any lack of workload. Even as Hassan Haskins, I think, is their insurance policy.
Say, is he the clear number two, Haskins? Because it seems like the Titans continue to not take the number two running back position seriously at all.
No, God, no. Well, why would they? They just now broke the first one, right? It's been a couple of years since they've had to think about another guy. I would say that as far as snap counts are concerned, and just as somebody who's going to be involved in the passing game, Dontrell Hilliard is going to be the number two running back just based off usage. I think Haskins is Derek's backup, but in obvious passing situations, they perpetually take out Derek. And Hilliard is somebody who is going to take that Jeremy McNichols role, which is, you know, they thought Darrington Evans was going to be that, and now he's playing for the Bears.
Yeah.
Henry was used a bit more in passing situations last year, at least as a receiver. Do you expect to see that continue or maybe even develop a little further this year?
Throw this guy some screens, man.
You know, I mean, they seem comfortable with it, and Derek's always done well with screens, right? Like, his thing is if you get him out in open space, he's going to make plays. It doesn't always have to be you know, four stiff arms of Jags defenders and a 99-yard touchdown run on Thursday Night Football.
Oh, like, come on, that's a cheap shot.
It happens. it happens quite frequently for Derek.
I mean, that's going to happen this year. I mean, so there's no point in pretending it's even a joke.
You start to feel bad after a while, but I think they got a little better chance on that quarterback. Anyway, yeah, Derek in space is dangerous, and I think Todd Downing recognizes that. I think that was something that was, I mean, he was going to come up on his career number of catches, and I think it was still under 20 in a season already. I think it was week 9, Halloween, when he was lost for the year with the Jones fracture.
Any thoughts in general on just kind of the Downing offense? Seemed like last year they weren't quite as fast paced as they were under Arthur Smith, maybe a little less play action, but it wasn't like they abandoned play action, just wasn't quite as intense. Any tweaks that you foresee this year compared to last year in the offensive design?
Yeah, I think just to kind of go back to the thing we were talking about earlier, they haven't run that much 11 personnel under Mike Vrabel since Matt LaFleur's first year with Marcus Mariota. It was very, very much off brand. I think that's because their tight ends weren't sufficient as far as the blocking that they want to do, and you couldn't trust them in that play action rollout game that seems to be such an effective weapon for them. And you know, I mean, they'd put Jonnu Smith in the backfield. We talked about 21 personnel earlier where you got two backs. Half the time it was a tight end between him and Michael Pruitt. So I think you'll see a lot more of that, a bit of a return to form as far as Todd Downing is concerned. And, you know, I think that they could stand to be more creative. But last year was such an anomaly, guys. I mean, again, 91 players broke the record by a mile. And that team still finished as the number one overall seed. I think both the 49ers and the Dolphins with the previous record had both finished under 500. They were bringing Deontay Foreman, who was probably, I mean, he was basically Derrick Henry for the second half of the season. They had to find ways to incorporate him and Hilliard the same week on short notice and then go play at New England with them. Like I think it was still pretty admirable that they found ways to get guys a game plan that would work for them. It didn't always work out, but I think there were so many limitations by A.J. Brown's lack of availability, Derrick Henry's lack of availability, and Julio Jones just kind of, I mean, that was a bunch of fireworks on the front end and a super fizzled out hamstring throughout the rest of the season. I think he ended up playing in 10 total and he didn't finish all 10.
Yeah, I mean, I think Vrabel was already trending towards having a reputation as an elite coach, but the scenario you just laid out, I mean, it wasn't even an exaggeration. Like, they were just, like, random guys half the time.
It was wild. Yeah, like, Golden Tate was on the roster for a hot second. I didn't actually see him in person, but Golden Tate was here and a legitimate option because they were so down bad.
I was going to mention Adrian Peterson, but Golden Tate, I didn't even realize.
Well, yeah, but let us not forget the Seahawks bringing AP and, you know, signifying. What is it, Ian Rappaport, signifying that they were.
Well, that's right, the commitment to winning this year. Push. That's right. No, that was real. They were going all in.
I lied on my season.
Crane has one final real question to ask you. Just real quick, I want to ask, do you know, by any way, the fantasy community's horrific nickname for a former Tennessee Titans great, Anthony Firkser?
Oh, no, but I can only imagine.
It was coined by Evan Silva, Pat. It was the Firk Daddy. Just wondering if you had ever heard
I wasn't that. Sure who coined that. I believe you've said it the most times.
I've said it the most times. It was Evan. And we tried to make the Firk Daddy catch on, and it never did.
You know, he's ASAP Firk here. And, you know, he earned neither of those nicknames throughout the course of the 2021 season. We honestly thought he was going to be real nice. I mean, he's been the closest thing to a slot option that they'd had, and that tandem with Jonnu Smith really worked well under Arthur. But it was a clown show how bad it was for Firkser last year. So yeah, neither of those nicknames, you know, respectfully to Anthony, neither of those terribly deserved.
It should never be said again, Firk Daddy. But I'm going to say it anyway.
The players call him Turkey Hole, which again, still something that I don't inquire too much.
This guy's addicted to bad nicknames. I guess it's not his choice, really. But
I mean, listen, if you guys watch the congressional hearing for Goodell, where they're listing off all Tom Brady's nicknames, I had no idea that Tom had that many. And sure enough, on Pro Football Reference, there they all are.
PRF, they kind of come up with ones that no one has ever said. So we need to get Firk Daddy on Pro Football Reference, actually.
And make sure I'm here for the Falcons interview so I can ask about Turkey Hole.
Yeah, Crane, we have one final question, Buck, then we'll get you.
Oh, that's right. They are all in Atlanta, aren't they?
They're all in Atlanta. McNichols is in Atlanta. Yeah, everybody's there. Yeah, I wanted to ask about Malik Willis. What do you think the plan is for Willis? And do you think we'll see Willis this year? I would assume that would be a bad year for the Titans if we do see Willis. But what do you think the plan is there?
Yeah, it would be disastrous if he got legitimate playing time. I mean, and you know, listen, I think that, and I've talked to their quarterback coach a lot about this, Pat O'Hara. It's really the first time that they've had a rookie. This is a ground up type situation. They got to teach him how to run a huddle. They got to teach him how to call plays. They got to teach him how to read a defense. It's, you know, Liberty is one of those offenses. If you guys do any pre-draft stuff, where the entire offense, wide receivers, offensive line, quarterback, they all look to the left. Somebody holds up a card. They all look back to center. Clap the hands.
Like a picture of Jason Sudeikis or something.
It's straight up high school stuff. So you've got a ground up build and a backup who they really trust. Logan Woodside is the backup quarterback until further notice here in Tennessee, just because they trust him to be able to operate at a level that they feel is adequate. I imagine they keep three quarterbacks on the roster, and I think he's got all the upside in the world. We saw legitimate progress just in the short time that we were out there with him since the draft. But yeah, that's a slow burn. They're working on that.
Well, again, not what we wanted to hear, but that's fine.
Well, Tannehill is three right now in draft, so actually I think if we can trust Tannehill to be the starter for the entire season, he's actually a great fantasy player.
You know, he's the durability was a thing certainly coming here that was always a question, but the guy has been nothing. In fact, he was the only thing consistent for them last year. I know the playoff game went how it went, but like that to survive the amount, the ass kicking that dude got last year, the most sacks with other than anybody but Joe Burrow, I believe. You know, he's been very steady for them so far.
Yeah, Tannehill is a tough, tough dude. So a great point. Great point to end the interview on too. Buck, thank you so much for joining us. Lots of really great stuff in there. And again, the Titans are a team like fantasy managers might say, yeah, you know, there's not that much interesting stuff going on with the Titans, but there really is just kind of intrigue all over the skill core. So thank you very much for helping us sort through that. And thank you so much for joining us.
No, a pleasure to be asked anytime, boys. Appreciate you having me.
Later, Buck. Thanks, nice, Buck. Nice to meet you on air here. So
yeah, nice to meet y'all too.
We'll do it again sometime. Thank you so much, Buck. We'll be right back after this with Jaguar Report's John Shipley.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Just a reminder, if you don't have the NBC Sports Predictor app powered by PointsBet, go download it now. The contests are free and easy to play, and you have a shot to win thousands by predicting what will happen in Major League Baseball, on the PGA Tour, and on the NASCAR circuit. We also have a special contest on Tuesday and Thursday called Battle of the Bets, where you can agree or disagree with our experts for a shot to collect some cash. Craig, every time I read a promo, I can't say the word contest correctly. I always go, like, I really, like...
What do you try to do?
I don't know. I try to say like contest. It just never sound natural when I'm saying it. But anyways, no more pointless riffing. It is now our great pleasure to welcome in Jaguar Report's John Shipley. John, contrary to popular belief, the Jags are a real team with real beat writers and everything. You are one of them. How are you? We know it's always a normal day in Jags country.
Hey, I'm great. You know, we have families and bills and, you know, everything else those other football teams have. You know, it's awesome. They even let us, you know, drive our cars to the parking lot. But, no, it's been awesome. I was telling somebody a couple of weeks ago that I was like, even as a reporter who, you know, I could care less what the end result of their games is, I hated going into their stadium last year. Like, you know, just listening to somebody, you know, feed you BS every day and, you know the team's not going anywhere. And I can't imagine how it felt for people who actually work for them. And now this year, I'm like, okay, actually, you know, enjoy going to work again. So they've definitely settled down some this offseason, which I'm happy for.
That's kind of always famous last words, I feel like, with the Jaguars. But yeah. It's good to be settled down for now. Yeah, toxic comes to mind.
Yeah.
The 2021 situation.
Yeah, an environment so toxic that the reporters don't want to go to work seems like maybe
a that seems pretty bad.
It was terrible. At one point, you know, probably halfway through it, I was like, wow, you know, Urban Meyer, you know, he doesn't give us enough stuff to write about. And then after, after like the James Robinson binging stuff, I was like, dude, give us less. Like, please, man. Don't have a prepared statement every time.
That's got to be a first, just begging an NFL coach. We're just begging you more. For less content.
I never thought I would know more about the team I'm covering than the head coach. I felt like that last year.
Yeah, Urban Meyer comes to you, John. Like, who the hell is LaVisca Chenault? What is this all about? Can you tell me about this, John?
I got a video. I've tweeted a few times, but it was after one of their one of only his two wins with the team, which is hilarious. That one of his funniest moments came. It was after the Bills game. He was talking about how good the defensive line played, which you know they did. You know they beat down Buffalo's offensive line. They did.
That was weird.
And, it was. And Adam Gotsis, who, you know, he's one of the more underrated players, really good run defender. He kept calling him Alex Clancis. And eventually was like, man, who are you talking about?
Clancis?
Alex, they didn't have anybody named Alex.
Is that a real Urban Meyer under the impression that's a real last name for anyone, let alone Adam Gotsis?
Yeah. And that was after a win. So
that's a real missed opportunity for us as far as blurbs go.
Yeah, I know. Damn. Do you think he knew who Aaron Donald was? Was that overplayed? Was that like misinterpreted? Did Urban Meyer know who Aaron Donald was?
Is this an extended bit by Urban Meyer?
I'm sure he knew to an extent who Aaron Donald is. I don't think he could give you like a Wikipedia paragraph of any part of his career. Like I don't think he could tell you when he entered the NFL or anything like that. But I think he knew a little bit about him. But I mean, when I first heard that story, I was like, this seems, I'm going to say, semi-plausible, because when we were getting ready for the week one game against the Houston Texans, somebody asked him, and he would later go on to tell us, I think, to avoid questions like this, I mostly focus on the offensive side of the ball, like the defensive coaches do their stuff.
Oh, boy.
Somebody asked him, they were like, so who's an offensive player on Houston's offense who scares you? And the first name that came to his mind was, of course, Joe Mixon. Once he figured out, hey, he doesn't play for Houston, he's like, oh, I was watching Bengals tape, and I'm like, you guys play them in like week five, what are you talking about?
He might have really he might have really had that game circled, because that was the game where he ended up staying in Ohio, of course, so maybe he just spent the whole summer and fall game planning for that game.
That's a good point. There's a bit of a trend right now going around fantasy Twitter where fantasy writers are getting their spouses to try to name an NFL player from every team. I think I would love to see Urban Meyer's wife play that game with him.
Urban Meyer probably knows more NFL players than my wife, who just like can't. My wife is into some sports, but it was the class. I turned on a football game once, the only time I ever turned on a football game. I asked her, I saw her like staring at the screen, which she like never, ever, ever does when I'm watching football. I was like, wow, she's actually looking at the screen. And I was like, do you like know anything that's going on the screen like at all? Could you like tell me the first thing about what's going on? And then she first said that she wasn't actually looking at the screen. She was just like zoned out. And that too, that no, she couldn't say like even the first thing about what was happening.
She was meditating.
both those matched perfectly.
It's better. Football is probably more enjoyable if you just zone out,
honestly, and
stare at the screen. Jaguars football would probably be more. No offense, John, but
it's more or less what most of our Sundays turn out to be.
I had one more like Urban Meyer thing, but we got Urban Meyer's the past. Doug Peterson is apparently the future, and that's where we have to begin, is this Jaguars backfield where, I mean, this is all fantasy managers are kind of caring about, trying to, like, discern right now, is what do we expect Travis Etienne's usage to be as he returns from his lost rookie season? We have James Robinson rehabbing a torn Achilles tendon. Is it kind of all systems go for Travis Etienne, who seemed poised to get pigeonholed as, like, only a third down only guy by Urban Meyer, despite being, you know, an elite early down back for Clemson, historically productive early down back. Just what is the initial 2022 outlook for Travis Etienne and his usage, John?
Yeah, no, I actually think it's really, you know, while I think the Jaguars could use him in a similar way to maybe how they envisioned last year, you know, getting him with a lot of mismatches, even splitting him out at times, I think he's, you know, exactly like you said, more likely to be an early down back, you know, under this Jaguars regime than last year. You know, they made that weird comment when they picked him last year that he was a third down back. But, I mean, you go back to Etienne's.
It was very weird. I spent way too much time thinking about this.
Yeah, my face when I heard it was like, oh, my God, what did they just do? But, I mean, Etienne, you know, and just looking at him at practice, standing next to the other running backs, I mean, you can see he's clearly the most athletic, the most explosive guy. But on third down, you don't want him in the backfield protecting the quarterback. It was like that at Clemson, and it's going to be like that even more so in the NFL when, you know, these size and speed differences are even more significant. So I think he'll definitely be somebody who kind of commands a presence on first and second down. But I really think once healthy, James Robinson is going to be the kind of go-to guy on third down. I mean, you look at the other guys in their backfield, you know, between ETN, Snoop Connor's rookie, Ray Crowell Armstead's a complete question mark after basically losing out, you know, half his career to this point due to COVID. So I think, you know, once Robinson returns, I really think third down is going to be his. But until then, you know, it really is full systems go for ETN. Like he didn't look limited at all this spring. And, you know, obviously that was just in helmets and shorts, you know, not shoulder pads. The spring is more for passing instead of running because, you know, you can't really do anything between the tackles. But it didn't look like he had any problems cutting on his injured foot. He looked just as explosive as he did last year. I just think the natural, you know, limitations to his skill set, which is the same as it was coming out of Clemson, is that, you know, he'll be a great guy on first and second down. Third down, I think still, you know, he has to kind of prove himself.
And do you think that Robinson's path there to those third downs is really about blocking to where
yeah. –
Because the concern for me would be, you know, the Achilles tear, we've seen recent examples that it still looks to be a year plus type of injury. Cam Akers came back last year within the same season, but he didn't really look like the pre-injury Cam Akers. But I guess to your point about the depth chart, like they don't really have a backup plan, it seems like. So even if Robinson maybe has lost a little bit of explosion, do you expect him to have a pretty significant role?
Yeah, I do think his role would primarily be as, you know, the kind of third down, the fact of blitz pickup guy. I mean, it's a big reason why he was able to win that job in 2020 to begin with. I remember when Leonard Fournette got, you know, released, there were a lot of people inside the building who thought Ryquirl Armstead was, you know, going to be that next guy. It wasn't just assumed
as we were some of those people, I think.
Yeah, I think I had a few tweets about it. It wasn't assumed Robinson because, you know, that kind of skill set doesn't show up as much in practice, you know, but once you get the regular season games, it stands out a lot. I remember last offseason before, you know, ETN got hurt, it was the first preseason game. ETN didn't go on the field until like the third or fourth series. And, you know, I know a bunch of people in fantasy were asking why. And I thought it was obvious on, I think it was the first or second drive where I know it was just preseason, but Robinson was able to identify a blitz from the second level before the linebackers even communicated to each other, shifted across the formation, picked it up so Lawrence could get his one of, like, I think two completions that game. So I just think he brings a really underrated value on that down. And I think even if he loses some of that early down work, which I do think he will, I think he's just going to offer enough value in that specific sense to still see the field somehow, some way. And the fact that he's also a talented receiver, you know, he's not going to be a mismatch or line up wide like Travis Etienne, but he can catch the ball out of the backfield. He can get yards after the catch. I think all that will help him stay on the field third down.
Any early read on goal line usage between the two guys?
I think it's tough right now, you know, since Robinson just started, you know, running again this spring. Mm-hmm. I think it was the last week of OTAs that he started running again kind of on the side. So it's hard right now until we see him really on the field. I would think honestly, ETN would have it, you know, over Robinson as things stand today, just because ETN's somebody they're actually able to go out there and get reps with. And I wouldn't really put Snoop Connor as a guy really out of conversation, somebody to, you know, vulture some touchdowns, because Doug Peterson, you know, the Eagles,
the committee guy, Doug Peterson loves him some committees.
He's
so in vogue right now in America.
he loved using, you know, three running backs on game day, you know, having three separate guys, you know, make some kind of play. So I really think when they took Snoop Connor, it was one, insurance for Robinson, and two, to also have that kind of bigger goal line guy in place of ETN if Robinson ever can't go.
Do you think, is Robinson going to be ready for week one? Is he maybe a reserve pup candidate? Do you think, I mean, I know that you've kind of maybe just be guessing, but
yeah,
what is your feeling of Connor, or excuse me, of Robinson will actually be ready for week one?
I feel like all like logic and everything we've seen from these kind of injuries before is to expect him to be a pup candidate and, you know, come back closer to week four, week five. When he talked after their last mini camp practice to media, and he was saying, you know, he is expecting me back in training camp. That's what his timeline is. The Jaguars, they smartly haven't been as bold to say, yeah, he'll be back for training camp. I personally would be surprised, but I think the fact that, you know, I don't think he would say that unless he actually felt like there was a chance of it happening. So I think there could maybe be an outside chance of him being ready for week one. But I just think, you know, seeing, I mean, Cam Akers, you know, another example, seeing how long this injury normally takes, I would think the earliest would be preferably around, you know, week four, week five.
See, I think, if I'm not mistaken, is the reserve pup list now four games instead
yeah,
of
six? They changed it this year.
All right, so I don't know, maybe it'll be a pup list guy, which would be kind of unfortunate. But I guess also fortunate, I mean, no offense to James Robinson, but fortunate if you're all in on Etienne this summer. And well, is it ETN, Etienne? Why do I always want to say Etienne?
I've heard both, and it's to the point where I'm not positive. I think it's ETN, but
right, I gotta get used to ETN. 55%
sure on that.
Gotta hit that E hard. gotta hit that E real hard. So it's weird. So you're basically saying the roles in the backfield are gonna be the total inverse of what football genius Urban Meyer seemed to have planned.
Yeah, which is it's crazy how our Super Bowl winning head coach might want to switch things up from what Urban Meyer did. It really seemed like Urban Meyer like viewed James Robinson as that undrafted rookie who
he could not get over that.
Yeah,
he had definitely like, not heard of James Robinson.
Right. He was like, I wouldn't have offered you at Ohio State. Why would I want you to, you know, play now? Like, he legitimately wanted Carlos Hyde in on him. And, you know, Carlos Hyde was notorious for, you know, kind of loafing, you know, with the Jaguars the last couple of years. He was known as somebody who turned it in. And I'm like, you're the only person in the city of Jacksonville who would rather this guy be on the field.
Peterson's probably planning on mixing it up in the passing game as well by having a functional passing offense.
big adjustment.
Big adjustment, truly. Christian Kirk basically seems like he has to be that guy. Sent shockwaves to the industry.
$200 million contract.
Crazy. Yeah. Crazy deal. Honestly, a little unfair to Christian Kirk, I think, because he was a good receiver last year and really, I think, took a step forward in Arizona playing out of the slot, but still being like their top option down the stretch with DeAndre Hopkins out. So I've been really curious about his deployment in Jacksonville. Like, is he going to be in the slot a lot? Are they going to use a lot of three wide receiver sets that then allow Christian Kirk to be in the slot? Because they do have Marvin Jones, Zay Jones, who both, I think, profile traditionally as kind of outside wide receivers. So that deployment, I think, would work. But do they plan to move Kirk around the formation a fair amount? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I think they definitely view Kirk, if you had to ask, you know, where he's primarily going to line up and see his most work for him, I would say definitely in a slot. You know, I put a story up on the site the other day where I talked to their wide receivers coach, and, you know, he was saying when they were doing their scouting for free agency, they had receivers broken up into outside receivers and slot receivers, and they had Kirk in the slot receiver group. But he said the more he watched him, you know, he watched pass just last season, and he was like, this guy can win on the outside as well. And that's something that Peterson, Press Taylor have said. They said that, you know, when they go into 12 personnel, they still think he can be a guy to keep on the field on the outside. They think in certain games they can have him line up outside. So I do think it'll be a matchup and probably week to week specific in terms of how he's actually deployed. But I would expect, you know, him to be the starting slot receiver, you know, obviously still in the field, probably with Marvin Jones and 12 personnel. And I think that's, you know, like you said, Marvin and Zay Jones on the outside, Kirk in the slot. I think that's what you're going to see most of the time with them. And I don't think the Jaguars are signing Kirk and expecting him to, you know, be Ja'Marr Chase and line up on the outside and win downfield, you know, 10 times over, you know, a 2 or 3 week span.
He always seems like, yeah, slightly miscast in that role in Arizona. Kirk's weird. He's like solid at everything. And I feel like no one has like truly found like his niche yet, even though he's been a very good NFL player. So yeah, I'd be very interested.
Yeah. To see. I think that they're really going to, I'm not sure if this is the type of offense that, you know, obviously he got paid, you know, a buttload of money and he's being
$450 million.
he's being paid like the top option, but I'm not sure this is the kind of scheme, you know, going back to Peterson's days in Philadelphia, that has a number one receiver option. You know, I really think it could – I think there'll be weeks where Zay Jones has more targets than Christian Kirk, which would be hilarious weeks, you know, online to kind of gather
here for the content. Opinions.
Yeah.
Yeah, highest paid athletes in the world are Kylian Mbappe, Mike Trout, then Christian Kirk. That's where it goes.
Do you think there'll be
like that one, Curry? Sorry.
He didn't take any in Bitcoin.
No, sorry, Kareem. Yeah, you go with the actual question.
Well, I was just going to ask about the rotation behind Kirk. You know, you mentioned Marvin Jones in two wide receiver sets. You think he'll be kind of locked in ahead of Zay Jones in two wide receiver sets? And then behind the Joneses, do we see a Jamal Agnew? Do we see a Laviska Shenault return from the ashes to get some work in the slot? You know, because it does seem like, you know, if Kirk's maybe rotating to the outside, it would be unusual to have Zay Jones or Marvin Jones in the slot. So that would potentially open up snaps for another receiver.
Yeah, I mean, Marvin Jones specifically is somebody who I don't think the Jaguars see somebody as, you know, and they'll say, you know, publicly, we think all of our receivers line up everywhere. I don't think from other conversations that Marvin Jones is somebody they really see as an inside player. So when it comes to a rotation, you know, in the slot, I do think it would go Kirk and then Shenault, Agnew.
Oh, yeah.
I think Zay Jones is somebody that you'll see there. Evan Ingram's another person I think you'll see there. I do think as things stand, like in their, you know, 11 personnel offense with three receivers, that they are locked in with Marvin, Zay Jones on the outside, Christian Kirk in the slot. I don't think there's any chance of anybody but those three guys being the week one starters, no matter really how camp goes. You know, they're really high on Zay Jones and Marvin Jones. Yeah.
No offense.
I mean, he has to
prove the operative word there.
Yeah. And I think when you look at Marvin Jones, I still think that they're high on one, his production, his leadership. You know, they basically, my conversation with the receivers coach, he more or less said that all the receivers came into this offseason knowing it was Marvin Jones's room from, you know, like a culture and leadership standpoint. So I think that alone is going to earn him, you know, a pretty large spot in the offense. He's also the only guy out of their top four projected pass catchers who has any experience with Lawrence before. So I think just that in-game kind of chemistry and history will help. But I do think Shenault will firmly be their, you know, number four receiver option. I think they see him as a guy who can line up inside or outside, though I think he needs to be inside. I think the worst thing that happened to his career so far is last year when DJ Chark got hurt. They moved him to X receiver, and it was clear after like a game that it wasn't going to work, but they did it for like a month and a half. And after he caught like four passes during that span, they switched it up and expected him to go right back into the slot seamlessly. And I feel like when you watch him last year and you break down his issues last year was the first year in his football career, like even going back to his Colorado years, that he had issues with drops. You know, he wasn't, you know, a dropsy kind of player. Issues with utilization and route running before, absolutely. But last year was the first year he really put the ball in the field. And I think a big part of that was his, you know, kind of convoluted usage, some confidence issues. So I do think he'll get a chance to play, you know, this year. I think he'll get some design stuff. He'll be the fourth receiver, you know, on the field. And, you know, receiver is a position where you're always going to find an injury at one way or another. So I think any of those top three guys go down, I think Shenault's going to be the first guy to step up.
So you mentioned Visca is the number four receiver. The number four receiver in a Doug Peterson offense traditionally gets about 175 targets, right? If we're just getting to project this for fantasy.
Over the first half of the season.
Yeah. So you laid out the rotation behind Christian Kirk, and that all made a lot of sense to me. Like, so like from a playing time perspective, but from like a usage perspective, who do you think is the second most targeted pass catcher on the Jaguars.
I think it's Marvin Jones. I really do. I think strictly from the fact that this is already an offense that is, it's not going to push the ball downfield a ton outside of, you know, some of the back shoulders that Marvin Jones, you know, already showed you could get last year. I think, you know, a lot of the timing stuff, RPOs, those kind of short to intermediate passes from the outside. And again, like I said, he's somebody who Lawrence has that in-game chemistry with. You know, they spent really all of last year, you know, together. They had some ups and they had some downs. And I think, you know, they'll come out on the other side this year with a better, you know, kind of connection than they did last year when, you know, Marvin Jones was for some reason catching balls from Gardner Minshew for half a training camp.
So another guy, we'll get you out of here after this one too, John. Evan Engram, kind of like the classic prototypical most talented guy in the world, yeah. Always seemed ready. He's always kind of on the verge in New York, and it never just happened. Do you see him having like enough targets and receptions to be like a fantasy viable guy this year? Or to me, he's got that kind of contract, but do you see Evan Engram's usage in Jacksonville translating to fantasy viability?
I do, because I think when you look at, one, the role that he's in, you know, in Doug Peterson's offense, I mean, Darren Arnold's a solid pass catcher for what the Jaguars normally have at tight end.
We talked about Dan Arnold way too much last year.
Yeah, exactly. That, the way I've described it to people is Darren Arnold went from, like, the Jaguars' best pass catcher to their number two tight end. And that's, you know, if you want to, like, talk about their improvement this offseason, that basically sums it up. So I think Engram is good enough to kind of command those targets in an offense that really emphasizes it. And I think the fact, you know, when you look at the rest of their weapons on offense, you know, like Marvin and Zay Jones, they aren't guys who are going to be mismatches athletically. Christian Kirk, you know, there are some guys that he'll run by, but I don't think he's somebody who, you know, you're betting to be a guy you really move around the formation to be a mismatch. So I think Engram will have a lot of stuff designed specifically for him. And, you know, I'll be honest, I think a one-year contract might actually work in his favor in terms of production this year, because, I mean, he's a guy who you talk to really anybody inside the stadium about guys who have come in and, you know, really worked, you know, above and beyond, and guys who have chips on their shoulders. And it seems like he leads the pack. Like, he seems genuinely ready to make people forget he was a Jason Garrett and Daniel Jones utilized tight end. He said that, you know, the Jaguars actually offered him a multi-year contract and he wanted a one-year contract. He said because he didn't think he got to showcase his talents and his skill set in New York's offense. I think he sees this offense as a chance to do so. And yeah, for a lot of guys having the pressure of, okay, maybe this is my last chance to cash in, I think it could impact them. And I think that could be a, you know, a case here.
I want to ask him just quickly about Trevor Lawrence and his affinity for the tight end, because it seemed like he really did target the tight end heavily last year. I mean, James O'Shaughnessy got 8 targets in week 1. So not just a connection with Dan Arnold, which he also had. Do you think that was kind of the offensive design that, you know, that Bevel system's not necessarily known for, like, having a feature tight end? So I wonder, you know, if that's maybe Lawrence or just kind of a lack of other options.
I think it was a little bit of both. I think when you go, I mean, going back to Clemson never used tight ends. You know, I mean, I remember somebody did a story about Lawrence utilizing tight ends at Clemson. It was like a combined 3 touchdowns thrown to them during his career there. So I didn't come into last season expecting tight ends to be utilized heavy. But, you know, like you said, James O'Shaughnessy, until he got injured, was one of their more targeted players. Dan Arnold, when he got back, was one of their more targeted players. I lean to part of it being, you know, they didn't have as many other quality options. You know, once DJ Chark got hurt, and they put LaVisca Chenault outside, that kind of, you know, really torpedoed the receiving room. Defenses could hone in on Marvin Jones. And I think tight ends generally are, you know, a friendly target for rookie quarterbacks because they're wanting to get rid of that ball quickly, especially over the middle of the field. So I do think that it's a position Lawrence learned to utilize last year. And I'm just talking about Engram specifically, I think looking at skill sets that Lawrence has thrived at throwing to both at Clemson and with the Jaguars, it's the bigger body types with, you know, big catch radius guys who can win downfield, you know, guys like Justin Ross, DJ Chark, Dan Arnold, Laquan Treadwell. These are all guys he's, you know, been good throwing to because he's so willing to, you know, give them a chance to win downfield. And Engram is really the only guy on the Jags roster this year who, you know, kind of classifies as that type. So I really do think he's a good fit with Lawrence and his skill set and the offense.
Makes a lot of sense with Engram, infamously slow to develop position, quarterback chaos, coach chaos in New York. So he would actually make a lot of sense as a late bloomer.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And like I said, I think he's you know, he's obviously betting on himself, but if it all works out, you know, I could see him being like a serious name to watch next offseason, you know, when the free agency market comes again. And I'm sure the Jaguars are hoping he has an okay year, not a great one. Yeah.
He wants to become Jared Cook 2.0, basically have a disappointing start to his career and then just get a increasingly like escalating series of 1 year contracts.
Yeah. Or at least Eric Ebron.
Yeah, exactly. At least get in the Ebrons.
I have to. Whenever I write about Ingram, I think it was the other day. I started writing and called him the most athletic Jaguars tight end since, and I couldn't remember. Like I was like, can't say James O'Shaughnessy. That's not impressive. And I was like,
no, it's O'Shaughnessy.
And I was like, Julius Thomas was fat when he was in Jacksonville. So that one wouldn't work for anybody. I was like, you can't say Mercedes Lewis because he ran even like a 5.0 40 in his prime. Yeah. So I think Ingram will definitely be a newer type of guy.
In franchise history, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, John, awesome stuff. Lots of great info on the backfield specifically. It's just going to be a really interesting one to follow. And like, it's such a hard receiver core to parse. I think you gave us a lot of good stuff there. And a lot of good stuff just trashing Urban Meyer. It's really
it was fun. He makes it easy.
Why you had you on, basically.
As long as I got to live with the memories of that year, I'll keep on reliving them.
Thanks so much, man. We'll do it again sometime. Yeah, rest up, because I'm sure it won't be a normal summer in Jacksonville, even though it should be a normal summer in Jacksonville. Thanks so much for joining us, John.
Appreciate it, guys.
Crane, now, are we going to talk about the Colts and Texans, I guess?
That was the plan, yeah.
That's the plan, to talk about the Colts. The Colts are just a really weird team to me, because I mean, they're the betting favorites to win the AFC South over the Titans, at least a lot of the places you look, but there's just like a lack of compelling fantasy situations, really, where like all like the oxygen is being taken up by like Nyheim Hines might catch 5 more passes this year. And that's where I will begin with you. And like Nyheim Hines, do we believe in this hype, or are the Colts actually, can they actually take Jonathan Taylor off the field like at all? And do we have reasons to buy into Nyheim Hines' back pass catcher hype?
I think there's a reason to buy in to an extent where, you know, I kind of do buy the, like, let's discount JD McKissick because he's now getting Wentz. Let's bump Nyheim Hines up a bit because he's getting Matt Ryan, who probably will throw to the pass catching running back. I mean, Cordarrelle Patterson even last year is a example of that, but, you know, supported Devonta Freeman and everything. So, and just kind of a less mobile guy who's going to be checking down, you would imagine, a fair amount. So, in that sense, I think Hines just kind of becomes more interesting because of the quarterback change. But then also, they are kind of incessantly talking him up. I don't know what that's ultimately. Yeah. And like, man, it would not be very smart to take.
John Taylor's a good pass catcher, all things considered.
Yeah. And kind of in the Derrick Henry mold, or like, you know, what Nick Chubb, I think we think these guys would be if they got a little bit more work. Like, it's not traditional, you know, it's not Christian McCaffrey, but it's explosive plays from a big back who gets up to speed quickly and has really high end top speed. And, you know, is incredibly tough to bring down once he gets there. So, I mean, Jonathan Taylor came in with yards per route run in college that rivaled Saquon Barkley. So he was always kind of a guy who could be used in the passing game. Again, not like, it doesn't seem as obvious as some other passing down backs, but you probably would hate to see a lot more Nyheim Hines.
It's like, why would you do it? I mean, Nyheim Hines is a good pass catcher, but he's not better enough than Jonathan Taylor, I feel like, to sacrifice those snaps or those shots. Yeah, like what could be like a 70-yard touchdown on a screen to Jonathan. Okay, Jonathan Taylor, yeah, he's definitely slipperier side to side than like Derrick Henry is. And I do wonder, so much of the Nyheim Hines hype, even from like the Colts coaching staff, I feel like is like based on the fact that Matt Ryan like checked down so much to running backs. But I just wonder like how much of that was survival mode behind what was just annually horrific offensive lines. And he finally has an actually good offensive line with the Colts. So I just don't know if I can buy into this at all. And I don't want to. That's also for sure that I don't want to.
Yeah, I definitely don't want to. And no one is, right? Jonathan Taylor's the consensus 101. You really don't see him go past 101. It's also one of those things where when someone gets locked in as the consensus 101 and you're going to draft a bunch of teams, you might as well just take them there and you'll get McCaffrey or Kupp or whoever else you want. Plenty at the 102. But yeah, the fantasy community not buying the Hines stuff, really. And it's not like Hines' ADP is super, super high. I think he's appropriate. I have taken him. I've mixed him in. But he doesn't come with any contingent value. Because
he's the RB 43, by the way, on underdog. Hines.
Yeah, that seems fine to me.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of fair enough. Like, you can't really complain about it. Like, why complain about the RB 43, I guess? But
yeah, I guess the big thing is, like, this time of year, I would be prioritizing guys with contingent value a bit more because training camp has not started. Like, we do have to remind ourselves in this era where we draft nonstop, like, as soon as the week 17's over, we're already drafting almost for the following
and the next year. Week 17. Even yeah, though you don't know the week 17 schedule yet, you're forecasting.
It's still all that matters, Pat.
Yeah, you're forecasting what the week 17 schedule might be.
Yeah, you got to get those divisional opponents because they're more likely to play each other.
You know, it's going to be divisional, probably.
I mean, I think, you know, the small amount that I guess some pushback on Hines' ADP would be if there was ever a time to fade kind of the pure satellite back guy who will probably cede a lot of touches to Philip Lindsay or whoever else if Taylor would get hurt. I mean, why would you be prioritizing that archetype right now when you could take a guy who might be a true bell cow if the start in front of him goes down in training camp? So I think Hines is someone I'll probably draft a little bit more of once we're in like September. But talk about the pass catching, like his yards per route run over his career, 1.43. It's not amazing. This is Nyheim Hines. It's not bad, but it's not amazing. Jonathan Taylor's at 1.3, which is kind of in the same range. But, like, you know, you see guys like, you know, Derrick Henry, Ronald Jones, kind of guys we think of as like people who are not pass catchers at all. They're below one.
Say Ronald Jones is somehow below zero.
Yeah. No. Devin Singletary, I believe, was the lowest in the league last year at like 0.65 or something. So, you know, double that for Jonathan Taylor. He's a guy that can and should be out there on passing downs. Basically as much as he can handle, I think.
So the Colts with like weirdly little skill core turnover, we're talking a lot about Nyheim Hines. And we're, of course, as you do every June, talking a lot about Paris Campbell. I mean, this time it counts for Paris Campbell, or is this just like Lucy with the football? We can't go back there no matter how good he looks in shorts and t-shirts, or could this actually be like a late blooming type situation for an offense that has the targets there for the taking? Like, if he could actually stay healthy, I mean, this role, it's not like you have to be taking a role from someone. Like, the role is there for him for the taking. But do we just need to move on from Paris Campbell in fantasy?
I think we should be open to reports about him looking really good. I haven't been taking him a lot yet, but I think he's someone that I would probably buy the training camp hype on a little bit if it comes. Like,
because they need him. Anytime it's someone they actually need, you know, you can pay a little more attention to, like, because it's not like he'd have to like jump people. Like, they actually need him.
Right. And I think I'd be taking him still in the 17th, 18th round, but he'd probably get in the mix a bit more for me. And probably, to be honest, a pretty decent pick even now because of that role that you're mentioning. Zach Pascal is gone. So there really is that slot role that's opened up. And even if they sign someone, which feels like maybe they will.
Yeah.
The available guys are, you know, I guess they could bring T.Y. Hilton back, but the guys that we primarily think of are Will Fuller and Julio Jones, who are both clear outside wide receivers. So that would really impact Alex Pierce, who's kind of at least in college, a one-dimensional outside deep threat. He's not playing in the slot. So Paris Campbell, I think, actually fairly locked into the slot role, again, if he can, you know, stay healthy for the first time ever.
Yeah, I could much more easily be talked into Paris Campbell than Nyheim Hines, which isn't like a groundbreaking opinion, obviously.
Upside, right?
There's much more unknown upside with Paris Campbell. And it is always notable when the coaching staff is kind of like the one leading the hype train. And they're doing that with Nyheim Hines, but they're also doing it with Paris Campbell. So there's so much unknown upside there. Yeah, it's kind of like a classic zero risk late round flyer. Because I don't really see his ADP like developing, like overheating too much, Paris Campbell.
I don't either. I think he could maybe even become like less drafted if they do sign a Julio.
That's true. But you mentioned Alec Pierce. I bet he wished that he ended up somewhere other than Matt Ryan. Because I just feel like Matt Ryan's not going to be taking the kind of shots Alec Pierce needs to be winning. Like contested throws down the field, basically.
Probably not. But I do think that it's worth considering that if Alex Pierce, you know, was Alec Pierce.
You're fired.
Did you say Alex or did I bring that in?
You said it first. Then I came in with a subtle Alec. And
got
then
it.
You said Alex again. So then I all fired right. you.
Well, you know, Denny's supposed to be on here.
Had a good run.
The one time, I guess everyone just on this episode gets fired. Danny, feel better about that, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, why do you think Denny's not on today?
Wow. Did it finally go through?
But they apparently are preparing a counterattack, and I'm afraid he'll be back on Thursday.
So Alec, not Alex Pierce. You know, he was Sky Moore, or maybe George Pickens, or, you know, one of these guys that we were a little bit more excited about pre-draft. And was, you know, frankly, more productive in college.
He's the kind of guy, not to cut you off, but to cut you off. When I watched like Desmond Ridder film, the only thing that ever stood out to me was Alec Pierce. It's like, wow, this guy is, and that was before I knew he was like a prospect. This is like, I was like, damn, this guy's like kind of awesome. And then I found out he's like actually a prospect himself. And I was way more impressed with him than Desmond Ridder.
Yeah. And I'm not impressed with Desmond Ridder either. And so I think I should probably be a little bit more open to Alec Pierce, because there's a chance they don't bring in anybody. And if they don't, he's going to play a ton. Like, he has to play a ton. And the upside dream scenario for him, I think, is basically Terry McLaurin, you know, just kind of one of these guys who, for whatever reason, didn't have a ton of production, but is a special athlete and has an ability to win downfield. Like, tape metrics, everything is like, yeah, this guy wins downfield. That's what he does. That's what he's for. That's why he was drafted where he was. The quarterback fit isn't ideal, but I mean, we saw what, like Case Keenum, Alex Smith. I mean, these have been the guys supporting Terry McLaurin. So to some extent, if Pierce is just better than his production profile indicates, which, you know, he does kind of profiles that super athletic downfield guy. Those have been some of the guys that have really surprised us production wise. So he is someone that I have drafted some of, not drafted a ton of, but definitely, I think, has a lot of upside if he's out there in two wide receiver sets, as it right now projects to be.
Yeah, Pierce, like you said, the quarterback fit's not ideal, but it's not like it's disastrous, which is like all you can ask for. Sometimes. So it's not like, yeah, it's like a hopeless situation. Matt Ryan wouldn't be who you'd draw up in a lab for Alec Pierce, but it's not like it's a disaster or anything like that.
Especially because, you know, you mentioned the offensive line. I think that's a big deal for Matt Ryan.
Totally. I mean, it could look like totally renewed guy.
Yeah, this could be a really big upgrade, offensive line-wise.
Quickly to close out the Colts, Michael Pittman, if you eliminate like the dudes who are hurt, Michael Pittman was the wide receiver 30 by average PPR points. He was the wide receiver 25 when you get rid of guys who only played like 5 or 6 games. Over under wide receiver 25 for Michael Pittman by average PPR points this year. What are you taking?
I will take the better than that, whatever.
The over, right?
I think the under would be, because
it's confusing. I'd say the over, because it's better, right? Yeah, you think, but higher than wide receiver 25. You're saying you take the over, the low?
I'm saying better. I think he'll be better than wide receiver 25. Yeah.
All right. There you go.
Better or worse? What are you taking?
I think like push, basically. I think he's going to be like the wide receiver 25. I like him a lot, but he's another guy where it's not like, I mean, Matt Ryan is not, he's not like the dude who likes to do these like difficult throws, I feel like.
Yeah. If you gave me like the wide receiver 18, I would take worse. And I might take the worst. Like, I'd probably lay more money on worse than 18 than I would better than 25. But I think he falls somewhere in that mix.
We have 90 seconds done with the Houston Texans, Pat.
We left a lot more time than I thought we would.
We're going to talk about them a little longer than that. And the first thing, I'm kind of like a little confused why Brandon Cooks has become like this cause célèbre and like fantasy circles this offseason. We're like, everyone's like, hey, Brandon Cooks, man, that guy's so underrated. Like, the numbers he put up last year at Davis Mills, like, he's the wide receiver 26 right now on Underdog. Do you think he's being underdrafted, overdrafted, or right where he should be?
I think he's probably, I don't know. I think it's fine. Like, I've taken him occasionally. I would say maybe he's slightly overdrafted for, like, the time of year it is, where, like, I don't know, like, what's going to break to where.
That's my whole thing. It's like, why pay full price for Brandon Cook? Like, you think there's, like, another gear coming for this guy at this age with this quarterback? That's what I just don't really understand about the Brandon Cooks pick.
Yeah, and I think partly, like, you know, again, this is I'm talking to fellow best ball sickos at this point, you know, who are drafting, who have already drafted, like, you know, 50 plus drafts, and you're keeping it light. Yeah. Those types of sickos. You didn't do the full 75 in your best ball mania barbell strategy. So yeah, I think for those types, like, it is hard for me to imagine Cooks' ADP rising significantly from here. So, you know, I think that's not the only consideration, but it'd be one consideration of, like, how heavy do you want to get on particular guys? Like, you know, is there going to be a bunch of hype to where you can't get them where they were going? And we've seen that already, actually, with a couple. Mike Williams has risen massively since these tournaments began. He's in the early third round these days. Gabe Davis has jumped up a couple rounds, and those are much more, I think, the types of players, you know, one on a really good offense, projectable role, going to play a ton. The other on a really good offense, projectable role, going to play a ton, and a younger player. And I think those are probably the archetypes where, you know, if you're thinking about what can I get in these drafts in this round in September, Brandon Cooks doesn't really profile the type of, he seems like he'll be right there where he is now. And, you know, in that case, it's like you're only getting injury downside, you know, that he maybe falls because he sprains his ankle or something, which obviously applies to all these guys, but some of them also can be balanced out by price upside, so to speak.
Yeah, that's just the thing. Even at wide receiver 26, I just want, like, a little more, like, untapped upside. And I don't think he's going to outpoint what he did last year. He probably won't significantly underpoint it, but it's just like, yeah, even a wide receiver 26, I want some more pizzazz, basically.
I think it could be, I think he's going to be more interesting in September once everything's kind of a little more settled. Again, more in the best ball stuff where you're going to be using, like in managed leagues where you have to slot in a guy. I don't really want Brandon Cooks as one of those guys. I want some more upside. But in later best ball drafts, I think he'll be fine where he's going now, because you get the upside with Davis Mills taking a step. Cooks is locked in, but you got John Metchie coming off an ACL tear, maybe not taking away that much target share, particularly early in the season, but maybe never. I mean, he's kind of more of a slot guy anyway. If Cooks has a similar target share to last year and Davis Mills takes a step forward, you know, maybe there is a slight additional level that he could unlock.
So that's the thing. It's modest, but Cooks does have increased target competition. And Metchie, whenever he does get on the field, second-year guys, Nico Collins, Brevin Jordan. Is there a second Texans pass catcher to like? Or is this just an offense, like, why try to get a piece of this? Why try to project any of these guys? Just look somewhere else. Is there someone, is there a second Texans pass catcher you kind of like?
I've taken some Metchie just because he's basically free. And, you know, he was an Alabama wide receiver, never super productive, but an early declare coming out of Alabama, going with good draft capital, I feel like shouldn't be completely free. So even with the ACL tear, which came in December. So, you know, I don't love Metchie, but willing to take him a little bit. And then the other guy, I think Brevin Jordan, you can
throw a little bit there.
A little bit there. Yeah. If you need like a third tight end in a kind of a weak tight end build in best ball, I think he makes sense. He wasn't that good last year, 1.19 yards per out run, not ideal, but not terrible either. And he was an interesting prospect. He had a breakout season in college in terms of his production, in terms of the share of his offense. And I also believe an early declare. So only a fifth round pick.
He's still quite young too. He's not even 22 yet. He turns 22 in July.
Yeah. So he's someone, you know, we don't see a ton of second year breakouts at tight end. It usually happens more like in the third year or something, but we could see him emerge to the point where he's like a 12th round pick in redraft leagues next year, right? He's like kind of thought of as a starting, don't like a firmly entrenched starting tight end. I know it's the upside is just immense, but I mean, like for completely free, for basically not drafted in a number of these leagues, I do think he projects to see the field more this year, and he is a pass catcher. So
yeah, he is.
Yeah, with a lack of really strong target competition, he I think has got some last round appeal.
Yeah, he was a 21-year-old who caught 20 passes in 9 games from Davis Mills. Like, not much competition, but you know, you don't just get given snaps. He earned enough snaps to catch 20 balls as a 21-year-old rookie in a really bad offense. It's not something you should just totally ignore with Brevin Jordan, basically. To end on the Texans, I mean, Damian Pierce is currently the RB40. Do you think he's even going to be the touch leader? And is RB40 overdrafted, underdrafted, just right for rookie Damian Pierce?
He feels slightly overdrafted to me.
I feel the same way.
It's one of those things where, like, if he was a little cheaper, I'd probably be drafting a lot of him. But where he's going now, I don't tend to draft him a lot, which always feels like, you know, a slight leak in my game. Where he's probably not, he's like not a bad pick, so I probably should mix him in more than I do. But I struggle with it because, I mean, we had like rival blurbs up on the site. One's like, you know, Damian Pierce could be the starter, and then the other's like the Texans are going to lean on Marlon Mack. So, you know, I think I could have to fire a bunch of people today because I didn't write either of those. So, you know, there's like some real uncertainty here about how this goes. I think it's probably a committee. And, you know,
it's Damian, a screaming committee and like all year committee, like not one that's going to like necessarily sort itself, like all year three backs, basically.
And Pierce, I mean, his production profile at Florida was bad. You know, he didn't do anything really. And, you know, you can blame the coaches for that. And they didn't use Kadarius Toney much, which, you know, maybe he's about to be a one and done in New York. So maybe that factored in there. I don't know. But, you know, also Van Jefferson, they didn't use a ton, although some may think that's justified as well. So, you know, there could be some coaching stuff here, but there could also be like if you're a committee college back, then you're not a great bet to be more than a committee NFL back, you know. And he did score a lot of touchdowns and his tape's really fun. He runs over guys. He's a really hard runner. He can make people miss. But, you know, even on like a per touch basis and stuff, his elusive rating and stuff like that wasn't that great. It wasn't terrible, but it wasn't like he was off the charts there at all. So I don't know. I'm a little skeptical of Pierce like coming in and taking this job. I think it'll be a committee. And so therefore, if it's going to be a committee, why wouldn't I take the cheaper of the two guys, Mac, right now, basically free 17th to 18th round in these drafts and kind of the half PPR formats. I think Mac's somewhat interesting, right? You're betting on touchdowns with both these guys. I think the touchdowns will be somewhat split up. It's not a great offense. So, you know, it's probably not that many touchdowns to go around, but, you know, maybe you get a couple usable weeks out of the cheaper guy.
Yeah, it does seem like the classic committee where you take the cheaper guy no matter what. But it's also like if you're looking for any like untapped, unknown upside, I mean, that's not Marlon Mack, obviously. That's not Rex Burkhead. Is Royce Freeman on this team? Darwe Ogunbowale might be on this team. Pierce makes sense where at least he's the only one where there's like theoretical unknown upside. But like you said, the downside just feels like pretty pervasive for a rookie and a guy without an amazing profile in this offense. So you could see the Pierce Ogunbowale come down.
He is on this team. I think Darwe Ogunbowale is always a red flag for a backfield because coaches love playing this guy. And he doesn't catch passes, but he plays third downs. He's an ultimate value suck for any fantasy backfield. I mean, that would be a tough scene for, you know, Damian Pierce and Marlon Mack because that means they're splitting up early down touches. And I think that's probably the most likely scenario here is that you're splitting early down touches on a bad team. So tough for me to get too excited about. I would prefer Pierce. You know, I want to bet on the rookie upside, but would like his price to drop a little bit.
Any final thoughts on the Houston football Texans?
You know, Davis Mills wasn't that bad last year. Do you think he's got anything? Does he have another gear?
He might. I mean, it's pretty – such a weird year for rookie quarterbacks where, I mean, was he like unquestionably the best rookie quarterback? Who am I forgetting? Was someone?
Mac Jones.
Mac Jones. Yeah, that's right. I mean, great sign for Mac Jones. I can't quite remember Mac Jones.
It frankly should be a great sign for Mac Jones. Coming in, we're like, is this the best quarterback class we've ever seen?
And then he might already been in. Was the best of them though. Davis Mills, though. Yeah, I mean, I thought it was interesting that from the jump this offseason, they didn't really seem to. There was no rumor. There weren't any rumors like Texans might trade for a quarterback. Texans might draft a quarterback. Like, they seemed set from the beginning with Davis Mills. And I frankly thought he did deserve a second year where if they weren't in position to make a big strike for a quarterback, I think he was a perfectly reasonable guy to give a second year and just see if there's a little more there. Like, if now maybe they'll get trapped in like the Derek Carr, or Ryan Tannehill zone where they have like a solid, they stay with a solid quarterback for too long, as you know, opposed to it, you kind of just always have to be searching for that truly elite quarterback. And I guess maybe that could be like the danger with someone like Davis Mills, where you get overcommitted to a guy that has no ceiling. But I thought he deserved a second year.
Well, it could be the best of both worlds with Davis Mills, because, you know, you kind of do the right thing, give the guy a second year, and then lose a ton of games and draft someone.
There you go. Exactly. The Gardner Minshew. So go
full Minshew. Gardner Minshew type.
Go full Minshew with Davis Mills. We did not go full Minshew with the show. The show was very good. Much thanks to Buck Rising and to John Shipley for joining us. Lots of really great stuff on the Titans and Jaguars. Hopefully we had some great stuff on the Colts and the Texans. We'll be back next week to talk the NFC South. We'll be back later this week on Tuesday and Thursday with Denny Carter. I'm told he's being rehired at some point. Lawrence Jackson will be there. Kyle Dvorak will be there. And, of course, Patrick Corain will be there. So thank you so much for listening today. We'll be back later this week.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.